Pub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 59, Corn, Cotton, and Condos, 378 years on the Motherbrook. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week we're going to discuss a waterway that's often overlooked in modern Boston. Everybody knows the Charles River, and most people know the Neponset River, but have you ever heard of the Motherbrook? It's America's first industrial canal built by Puritan settlers in the earliest days of Massachusetts Bay Colony, and it was vital to the development of Dorchester, Hyde Park, and Dedham. Plus, by connecting the rivers on either side, it turns the landmass occupied by Newton, Brookline, and most of Boston into an island. But before we talk about the Motherbrook, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
All the way at the southern end of Dorchester Avenue, or Dot Ave, just steps from the Milton town line, a brick building along the Neponset River tells the tale of a particularly sweet chapter in Boston's history. In 1764, James Baker and John Hannon leased space in a water-powered sawmill along the Neponset. They bought imported Central American cacao beans from merchants in Boston, Marblehead, Salem, and Newport. Soon, they were making the first mass-produced chocolate in North America. Earlier chocolate-making businesses, such as Captain Jackson's Chocolate Shop in Boston's North End, had to grind cocoa by hand using a mortar and pestle. You can see this process demonstrated by reenactors in the basement of the Claw House behind Old North Church. The technique Baker and Hannon pioneered used the sawmill's large water wheel to turn grindstones similar to those used to grind wheat into flour. The flat millstones were replaced by rollers made of granite, and later marble, and finally steel. These huge rollers allowed Baker to produce a much more finely milled, refined form of chocolate, and to crank out more of it in less time. At first, the work could only be done in the wintertime, as cocoa needs to remain cold to be hard enough to grind. Eventually, ice houses allowed the work to continue throughout the year, and the business could justify building its own mill buildings rather than piggybacking on an existing enterprise. Later, underground cooling rooms were dug under some of the mill buildings, with brine pumped through pipes to keep the temperature down. These hand-dug caves were in turn replaced by refrigerated warehouses in the 20th century.
Along with redefining how chocolate was manufactured in America, Baker Chocolate helped redefine how it was enjoyed. At the time James Baker started his operation in the 1760s, chocolate was enjoyed as a beverage, but it wasn't the sweet treat we know as hot cocoa today. It was mixed with herbs and spices, often including chili peppers, and consumed as a medicine or as a morning pick-me-up. Only in Spain did people sweeten their chocolate, as John Adams discovered while traveling through Spain in 1779. On December 10th, he wrote in his journal, "Breakfasted for the first time on Spanish chocolate, which fully answered the fame it had acquired in the world. Till that time, I had no idea that anything that had the appearance of chocolate and bore that name could be so delicious and salubrious." Starting in 1780, the Baker Company produced solid bars of unsweetened chocolate, which they marketed as Number 1 Premium. They had lesser varieties too, including Number 3 Inferior Chocolate, which was heavily cut with ground rice and marketed to plantation owners in the American South as a cheap energy source for enslaved people. All their early products were intended to be melted and mixed with water or milk to make a drink. It was only in the 19th century that the company began developing sweet chocolate bars for eating. One of these bars was developed in 1852 by a Baker employee named Samuel German. German's sweet chocolate became one of the company's most popular products, and was used for eating as well as baking. A popular cake recipe that used the chocolate became known as German chocolate cake. In the 20th century, Baker chocolate remained a nationally recognized brand, even after being bought by the conglomerate General Foods in 1927. Unfortunately, the parent company made a decision to consolidate its East Coast operations in the early 1960s, and manufacturing for Baker Chocolate was moved to Dover, Delaware in 1965. The remaining mill buildings and over 14 acres of land stood mostly empty for decades. In the 1990s, the site was finally redeveloped, and many of the mill buildings are now used for condos and apartments. In the show notes this week, we'll post a link to a PDF published by the Dorchester Athenaeum that you can use for a self-guided walking tour of Dorchester Lower Mills and the old Baker Chocolate Factory. We recommend taking the Mattapan High Speed Line from either Ashmont or Mattapan Square to Milton Station to get there. The old Pullman PCC streetcars used on the Mattapan line were built in the 1940s for use on the Green Line, and they are a historical experience unto themselves.
And for our upcoming event this week, we had to go a little bit farther afield than usual. With the holidays coming up, our event calendars were somewhat empty. Luckily, Sue Gaganian reached out with an event all the way up in Beverly. On January 4th, Historic Beverly is hosting an opening reception for a new exhibit about photography in the Victorian era. The exhibit goes hand in hand with the focus on photography in last week's show about the Harvard College Observatory. Plus, we're just generally photography buffs. Here's the description from the website. Join us for the opening reception for In Pictures, the Photography Sensation. Discover the sensationalism of photography in the Victorian era through photographs from the collection of Historic Beverly. Explore ambrotypes, cabinet cards, daguerreotypes, stereoscopes, and tintypes that not only show the growth and popularity of photography at the time, but also connects Beverly to an artistic medium that we rely so heavily on today with our smartphones, cameras, and Instagram. The reception begins at 6 p.m. at Cabot House in Beverly. It's a free program. They just ask that you RSVP through their website by January 2nd. We'll have a link in the show notes this week. And now on to our main topic, the Mother Brook.
The Puritan colonists, led by John Winthrop, who came to settle in Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630, traveled first to Salem in April, then settled in Charlestown, before finally moving across the river to Boston in late summer. Fearing attack by the neighboring Native Americans and mindful of the possibility of famine, the settlers spread out from Watertown to Boston and from Charlestown to Dorchester. It was too late in the season to begin planting field crops for the year, so they would have to rely mostly on imports from England to get them through the coming winter. Unfortunately, that message seems to have gotten mixed up on the way back to Old England. In late August of 1630, the New England Chronology records, "It having been reported in England that there were now provisions enough here, diverse ships came not so well supplied as otherwise they would, and there being miserable damage of our provisions at sea, and yet some imprudently selling much of the remainder to the Indians for beaver, we fall into great and threatening straits for want of food. The mortality increasing, many died weekly, yea, almost daily, so that the ships being now on their return, some for England, some for Ireland, there was not much less than 100, some think many more, partly out of dislike of our government, which restrained and punished their excesses, and partly through fear of famine, not seeing other means than by their labor to feed themselves, returned back, and glad we were to be rid of them." In the years to come, these hungry months would be a strong incentive to the Puritans for getting their crops in, tending them jealously, and making the most of every harvest. They would have planted wheat, rye, barley, and oats. The oats were intended largely for the horses, while barley was set aside for brewing beer. At a time when every source of drinking water was a potential source of deadly contagions, it made sense that they believed beer to be a healthier drink for the whole family.
Unfortunately, none of their English grains thrived at first in the New World. There wasn't enough barley to stock a family with the beer their children needed to grow up big and strong, and there wasn't enough wheat to allow them to bake the breads they knew from home. At the time, the English made fluffy white bread that wasn't too different from the white bread we all know and love today, but New England bread was a different animal. Luckily for our Puritan forebears, there was a grain native to the Americas that grew plentifully from Mexico City to Maine. The English dialect of the time considered any grain to be corn, so this new introduction was called Indian corn. It was maize, or simply corn, as we call it, and it quickly became a staple in the New England diet. During the early years, the settlers of Massachusetts Bay would have eaten a lot of thirded bread. It was called that because it was made from rye, wheat, and Indian corn in equal proportions. During the earliest years of the settlement, the grains would have been ground by hand, probably by women. There were two techniques for this. The first was to grind the grains by hand, using two hard stones. The top stone would have a hole through it, which the grain was poured in. Then it was rotated until the grain was ground finely enough to find its way out from between the stones. The other technique was a traditional Native American method using a large mortar and pestle made out of oak and pounding the whole grain into flour. Either of these methods would have been difficult and time-consuming, and it resulted in flour that was quite different from what we're used to today. Milling grain by hand meant that the entire kernel made it into the flour, rather than being bolted or sifted out and leaving pure white flour behind. Puritan flour typically included both the wheat bran and the wheat germ, as well as the white flour. In 2015, we attended an event hosted by the Partnership of the Historic Bostons, where we got to sample Puritan foods. As part of the event, we got to try some thirded bread that had been made using traditional methods at Plymouth Plantation. The milling techniques of the Puritans' separatist neighbors were similar enough that we probably ate bread very much like that of the early years in Boston. It was rich, chewy, and pretty good. It's easy to see why any demonstration loaves made at Plymouth Plantation sell out almost instantly.
With the production of flour taking up so much time that could be devoted to other labor, and resulting in a somewhat unfamiliar form of bread, you can see why the early settlers of Massachusetts Bay were eager to find a better way to grind their grain. As early as 1631, the first grist mill in the colony was established at Watertown. This early enterprise was a windmill, of a design similar to the traditional mills we've all seen in children's books or articles about the Dutch. Long, graceful arms hold cloth sails that catch the wind to spin a shaft that turns the grindstones. The entire mill rotates on a central hub, allowing the face to be turned into the wind. It's a design that originated in England in the 1100s, and my great aunt's family operated one in the countryside near London right up until World War II. Unfortunately for the proprietors of the windmill at Watertown, it only seemed to work when the wind was coming out of the west. In 1632, the government of the colony decided that the mill should be moved. They chose a spot on top of a hill so that the mill could turn to catch a favorable wind from any direction, and they chose a spot that was centrally located for more of the population. As a history of Boston's North End puts it, the colonial government decided to move the windmill as early as 1632, and although there were many hills in Watertown, Charlestown, Roxbury, and other places, the government chose Copse Hill in the North End. Because residents of other towns would have to travel to this windmill until they had mills of their own, the most convenient location for the windmill was near the ferries and the river, where it could be approached by boat on a regular basis. Indeed, the 1723 Bonner map of Boston that we reference so often shows a tiny hand-drawn windmill next to the burying ground at the top of what was then known as Snow Hill, just steps from the waterfront.
As the population of the colony grew swiftly during the Great Migration period, having the entire population come to Copse Hill to grind their grain didn't remain practical for very long. Towns throughout the area searched for solutions to this problem using the natural resources they had at hand. Dorchester, which was an independent town encompassing far more territory than Dorchester does today, had a population rivaling Boston's in the early 1630s. It also had access to the Neponset River. That resource allowed the town to establish the first water-powered grist mill in New England in 1633. The town records from November 3rd of that year say, "It is generally agreed that Mr. Israel Stoughton shall build a water mill, if he see cause. The said Mr. Stoughton doth promise not to sell away the said mill without the consent of the plantation first had and received." The town of Dorchester would grant Israel Stoughton land and timber to build the mill if he operated it for the benefit of the plantation and charged reasonable rates. The following spring, Stoughton erected a dam across the Neponset at a small waterfall just above the tidal basin. His mill hugged the northern bank of the river, with a water wheel driving the grindstones. 130 years later, this site would be the Baker Chocolate Mill at Dorchester Lower Mills. Today, it's where the Adams Street Bridge crosses the river, frequently congested with traffic coming from Dot Ave and Adams, Washington River, and Morton Streets. In 1634, the mill was on the far outskirts of the settlement, but today's traffic reflects how quickly it became an important crossroads. Adams Street was built to link the mill to the more densely settled northern part of Dorchester, and Washington Street was laid out by 1654 as a cartway between the mill and the settlement at Roxbury. Israel Stoughton's mill was just the first to be sited along the Neponset River, beginning what would become centuries of industrial use. Over 200 years later, the city of Dorchester set out to design an official seal in 1865, near the height of the use of the water wheels to power mills. Three buildings were chosen to represent the town's early settlement. The first church, representing the Puritan piety of the settlers, a small thatched schoolhouse, representing the importance of the colony's first free school, and Israel Stoughton's mill, representing industry. The Dorchester Historical Society says that the rude mill with its large wheel is seen upon the left bank of the Neponset River, the course of which river, from its source to its mouth, lay through the ancient territory of Dorchester.
Similar water-powered mills were built at Watertown and Roxbury later in 1634, and in Salem, Ipswich, and Newbury by 1636. Charlestown got a windmill in 1636, and Boston added a second one. However, two mills subject to the fickle winds were not enough to keep the growing population of Boston stocked with ground flour. There was also another drawback to windmills, as noted in the town records of Boston in June 1642. The windmill at the north end of the town was struck by lightning, shattering the upper sail in many pieces, and, missing the stones, entered the standard, rived it down in three parts to the bottom, and one of the spars. And the main standard being bound about with a great iron hoop fastened with many long spikes, it was plucked off, broken in the middle, and thrown upon the floor. And the boards upon the sides of the mill rived off, the sacks in the mill set on fire, and the miller, being under the mill upon the ground, chopping a piece of the board, was struck dead. But company coming in found him to breathe, and within an hour or two he began to stir, and strove with such force as six men could scarce hold him down. The next day he came to his senses, but knew nothing of what had befallen him, but found himself very sore. His hair on one side of his head and beard was singed, one of his shoes torn off his foot, but his foot not hurt. So you can see why windmills might be falling out of fashion. Boston didn't have access to a river with rapids or waterfalls it could harness to turn a water wheel, but it did need to find a way to provide a safer, more reliable means of grinding the town's grain into flour. On May 31, 1643, the town granted Henry Simons and a corporation that would be called the Proprietors of the Mill Pond the right to build a tidal mill in Boston. The Massachusetts Historical Commission describes why a tidal mill was a good choice for the young town of Boston. Tidal mills had several advantages over other types of water mills. By using salt water from the harbor, the mill could operate during the winter since the salt water wouldn't freeze like fresh water. The proprietors also didn't have to worry about a drop in water level during times of drought. Finally, with tidal mills, once a tide chart is established, the mill owner would know the precise day and time his mill would be operating.
The proprietors got exclusive use of a cove between the town's north and west ends, and the town supported them with timber and labor for building. In her book, Gaining Ground, Nancy Seashells describes the task at hand. The proprietors built dams from the ends of a natural causeway that already existed across the mouth of the cove in order to close off the cove completely, which then became known as the Mill Pond, and dug a mill creek through the neck between the mill and town coves. Water entered the mill pond at high tide from the Charles River through the floodgates in the causeway, and from the town cove through the mill creek, as it came to be called. An ebb tide water flowed back out of the mill pond, powering tide mills that were near the present bend in Endicott Street and other mills at the mouth of the Mill Creek. The Mill Creek roughly followed the line of today's Rose Kennedy Greenway. One of the original millstones was discovered during the construction of the Big Dig and is now set in the sidewalk outside Boston Public Market. The mills operated from 1644 to 1804. By that time, the mills had fallen into disrepair, and the mill pond was partially filled with refuse and sewage. In 1806, the decision was made to fill in the pond, and it's now the location of the Bullfinch Triangle.
After the first few years of famine and hardship, the English population of Massachusetts Bay Colony was growing rapidly. As the pace of settlement increased, new towns began to spring up around Boston. Milton and Braintree in 1634, Concord and Hingham in 1635, and then Dedham in 1636. That summer, about 30 English families traveled up the Charles River above the tidewater at Watertown in canoes. I frequently kayak the Charles through Dedham, so I know exactly what settler Moore Carew means in the conversation he recalled with Miles Courtney along that journey. The river took many turns, so that it was a burden the continual turning about. West, east, and north we turned on that same meadow and progressed none, so that I, rising in the boat, saw the river flowing just across a bit of grass in a place where I knew we had passed through nigh an hour before. Moore, said Miles then to me, the river is like its master, our good King Charles of sainted memory. It promises overmuch, but gets you nowhere. They landed at a great bend in the river, eventually entered into a covenant with one another to form a church and town, and called the new settlement Dedham. The settlers in Dedham weren't big fans of grinding their grain by hand, and they were skeptical of how effective a windmill would be given the local topography. They were inland, so they didn't have the tides with which to run a mill. Their town was founded on the banks of the River Charles, but that is a section of the Charles that's wide, slow, and placid. Great for traveling by boat, but useless for turning a water wheel to power a mill. That didn't stop the town from granting Abraham Shaw 60 acres of land in 1637 in return for building a corn mill on the Charles. The town ordered millstones to be imported from Watertown, and Shaw began work on the mill, but he died in 1638, and his heirs weren't interested in continuing the work.
So Dedham went back to the drawing board. Just outside the center of town, a small stream called East Brook flowed out of a marshy area and into a low valley, eventually into the Neponset River, in what was then Dorchester. The course of the stream dropped about 40 feet over 3.5 miles, which was plenty to drive a wheel. Unfortunately, East Brook didn't really carry enough water to power a mill. The town selectmen came up with an audacious plan. What if they could divert some of the plentiful water from the placid Charles into steep but scarce East Brook? On March 25, 1639, they ordered that a ditch should be dug at common charge through Upper Charles River Meadow onto East Brook, that it may be both a partition fence in the same, and also may form a suitable creek unto a water mill, that it should be found fitting to set a mill upon in the opinion of a workman to be employed for that purpose. They were so confident in their plan that the work moved forward without waiting to enlist a new miller. As with Shaw, an offer was published to give 60 acres of land to anyone who would build and maintain a corn mill. A tax was levied on landowners in the town to pay laborers to dig a ditch 4,000 feet from the bank of the Charles to a bend in East Brook. On July 14, 1641, water flowed from the Charles through the canal and into the Neponset River for the first time. Dedham prides itself on having created the first industrial canal in North America.
That's what happens when you identify a common community need, identify an ambitious plan to get there, and then you pay your taxes to make it happen.
True to the plan, a man named John Elderkin heard of the offer of free land and moved from Lynn to Dedham to establish the first mill on what was now called the Mother Brook. He built a dam across the newly swollen stream at a point near where Bussey Street crosses it today. His corn mill opened in 1641. The following year, he sold his interest in the mill with the rights going to John Allen, Nathaniel Aldis, John Dwight, and Nathaniel Whiting. In 1649, Whiting bought out the others and became the sole proprietor of the mill on Mother Brook. Soon, the demand for flour was beyond the capacity of Whiting's mill to deliver. The town granted permission to Ezra Morse to build a new mill upstream on the Mother Brook from Whiting's mill. The new enterprise was completed in the spring of 1665, and Nathaniel Whiting immediately began to complain to the selectmen. He was upset about the competition for both customers and water. As the animosity between Whiting and Morse grew, the town resolved in 1668 that, in time of drought or want of water, the water shall in no such time be raised so high by the occasion of the new mill that the water be thereby hindered of its free course or passage out of the Charles River to the mill. The proprietors of the old mill are at the same time restricted from raising the water in their ponds so high as to prejudice the new mill by flowage of backwater. However, at the same time, the selectman warned Whiting that he should be sure to repair his own leaky dam before coming back to complain about Morse again. It seems like this resolution was not quite satisfactory because in 1699 the town records say, 40 acres of land near Neponset River are granted to Ezra Morse in satisfaction to him for letting fall his corn mill at Motherbrook for the benefit of the Meadows and the other mills. Morse would open a new mill on the upper Neponset River in a part of Dedham that now lies in Norwood, next to a sawmill that had opened in 1664. Whiting's victory would be short-lived. By the early 1700s, there was a leather factory operating on the site of Morse's former mill.
He might have been loudly complaining about dams upstream of his corn mill, but in 1683, Nathaniel Whiting partnered with James Draper to build another dam downstream and start a new fulling mill. Fulling is the process by which wool cloth is scoured and thickened to make it stronger and more waterproof. Hundreds of rounded wooden hammers pound a bolt of woolen cloth that is fed slowly through the machine. This was the first textile mill in Dedham, an industry that would be the economic lifeblood of the town, and indeed much of New England, in the coming centuries. The site of the fulling mill would remain in the Whiting family for over 180 years. A fourth dam was built just downstream in 1787, where two Whiting descendants began making copper cents. A third Whiting descendant added another factory to the same dam where he manufactured wire. The Norfolk Cotton Manufactory took over Ezra Morse's old dam in 1807, building a large cotton mill. Cotton was still a novelty in New England in 1807, and Worthington's History of Dedham notes that the inhabitants felt a degree of pride in having a cotton factory in their town, and whenever their friends from the interior visited them, the first thing thought of was to mention that there was a new cotton factory in the town, and they must go and see its curious and wonderful machinery. Soon Benjamin Bussey purchased the cotton mill and Whiting's original mill site to expand into. That original dam is, of course, at Bussey Street, probably a coincidence. The copper cent factory at the fourth dam soon converted to cotton manufacture as well.
The cotton boom led to the fifth and final dam across the Motherbrook, even further downstream. Built in 1814 under the auspices of the Dedham Manufacturing Company, this is the dam that now stands in Reedville, and it's the dam that we walk our dog Duke across nearly every day. I know it can get kind of confusing, but the five dam sites are known as privileges, as in the privilege to build a dam. They're numbered from oldest to newest, so you have the first privilege at Bussey Street, where Nathaniel Whiting owned the first dam. Ezra Morse's second privilege is upstream from that. Then back downstream from the first is the third privilege, which started as a fulling mill. Below that is the fourth, founded by Whiting's descendants, and finally the fifth, where we walk the dog. The textile industry, both cotton and wool, would be the main business of the five mill privileges along the Motherbrook well into the 20th century. It was so profitable that it threatened to change the traditional way of life in Dedham. A history of the town published in 1827 laments a coming age in which landowning farmers no longer control the town's politics, instead ceding power to those who live in towns and work in the mills. This is the age in which little compact villages begin to arise in all parts of the country which afford any facilities for manufacturing and mechanical employments. Dedham has two places of this kind, the Courthouse Village and the mills on the banks of the Motherbrook. A new population is about to be admitted into the town, which must in time considerably affect its character. In point of interest, they will greatly contribute to the prosperity of it. In moral effect, no evil is yet perceived. The means of subsistence are greatly increased, and a wider field is opened for the various talents of men, and we can now perceive the utility of that policy which encourages the manufacturing establishments of this country by protecting duties. That manufacturing village along the banks of the Motherbrook is now known as Reedville, and it's where your humble hosts live. The Hyde Park Historical Society records how the name evolved over time. The locality now known as Reedville was as early as 1655 called the Low Plain, and after it became a part of Dedham, was known for years by the name of Dedham Low Plain. When the school district was there established, it naturally came to be known as Low Plain District.
By the mid-19th century, the mills were all important in Dedham Low Plain, and they were looking for a new name. James Reed was one of the principal proprietors of the cotton mill at the Fifth Privilege, and he gave his name to the neighborhood that was quickly growing up around the mill. School records fixed the date when the modern name was adopted. October 8, 1847. voted that the name of Low Plains School District be changed to that of Reedville. The mill at the time was owned by a corporation called the Dedham Manufacturing Company. The historians of Dedham were right to fret about the growing political power of the mill workers, but they misjudged the change that was coming. The workers in Reedville didn't take over Dedham from the existing leaders. Instead, they left the town of Dedham entirely. The residents of Reedville joined together with people in the Fairmont Hill neighborhood in Milton and in a settlement along the Boston and Providence Railroad tracks in Dorchester near the Neponset River. They petitioned the legislature, and on April 22, 1868, the new town of Hyde Park was incorporated. Textiles, water power, and the Mother Brook remained centrally important to the new town of Hyde Park. A promotional poster commissioned in 1890 shows a bird's-eye view of the town, oriented to put the mills along the Mother Brook and the Neponset front and center. At the time, the mill at the Fifth Privilege is identified as belonging to BB&R Knight Cotton, which you might know better as Fruit of the Loom.
Dedham got into the water power racket early with their development of the Mother Brook, but communities downstream on the Charles were quick to follow. Newton, Waltham, and Watertown were all heavily industrialized with a rapid succession of dams crisscrossing the river, as any modern kayaker can attest. And as textile mills came to dominate the economies of all these towns, they began to look jealously at the water diverted into the Mother Brook, as unfairly decreasing the amount of power that they could harness at their own dam sites. Their attitude was summed up in a much later editorial in the Boston Globe. It was the most audacious attempt of robbery ever recorded in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It was the effort made by Dedham to actually steal the River Charles. The bold pirates built a canal from the headwaters of the Charles across to the Neponset River, and by widening and deepening this Mother Brook, they were gradually robbing their neighboring town of its beautiful waterway. By the 1790s, the owners of mills along the Charles began petitioning the state legislature for relief. As a public waterway, the river was treated as de facto state property, and the Charles proprietors complained that they were suffering from the deviation of its natural course. The proprietors of the mills on the Mother Brook and on the Neponset River, which benefited from the increased flow introduced from the Mother Brook, petitioned the legislature right back. All sides sued one another, and in 1809, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that the diversion of water into the Mother Brook should not exceed one quarter of the total volume of the Charles River.
The Mother Brook proprietors weren't happy with this outcome and managed to talk the SJC into staying the enforcement of their order. Both sides continued litigating and negotiating and finally reached an agreement in 1831. A historical sketch of the Mother Brook, published in 1900, outlines the agreement, which is still in effect today. Finally, an agreement was entered into between the proprietors of mills on Mill Creek and Neponset River and the proprietors of mills upon Charles River on December 3, 1831, and filed in the Norfolk Records, which fixed the proportion of water as one-third to the owners of the mills on Mill Creek and two-thirds to the owners upon Charles River. This agreement is still in force today and governs the division of water which shall be allowed to flow into the Mother Brook. The sills were fixed in both streams, and provision was made whereby either party could have an adjustment made of the sills if they considered themselves aggrieved to the amount of water by due procedure.
Today, the sill fixed at the divergence of the Charles River and the Mother Brook has been replaced by a mechanical floodgate that can be adjusted to let more or less water into the Mother Brook depending on water levels in the Charles. It's a signal of just how much has changed along the Mother Brook in the past century. First, the independent town of Hyde Park is gone. Like Roxbury, Dorchester, Charlestown, Brighton, and West Roxbury a few decades earlier, Hyde Park voted to be annexed to Boston and ceased to exist in 1912. By the teens and 20s, the textile industry was in decline across New England and around the country. One by one, the mills along the Mother Brook went out of business. Today, the First Privilege is a park and playground, with a small stone and a plaque to mark the site of the first mill in this important industrial corridor. The mill buildings at the Second Privilege house a medical supply distributor. A strip mall and a Dunkin' Donuts sit on the site of the Third Privilege. The beautiful stone mill buildings surrounding the tall dam at the Fourth Privilege have been converted to condos. And the fifth privilege is maintained by the DCR as a last-minute addition to the Stony Brook Reservation, currently undergoing what seems to be a policy of benign neglect.
Once, there were big plans for the Mother Brook. In the early 20th century, recreation coexisted with industry. A 1915 article describes that, near the railroad bridge, several small boathouses are erected, and the town of Dedham has built a substantial bathhouse that is well patronized by boys. Though we suspect that they just didn't understand that swimming in an industrial canal was a bad idea. By the 1960s, the mill pond at the Fifth Privilege had been drained, and the owner was seeking permission to build a strip mall on the site. The DCR stepped in to purchase the land, cleaned up a junkyard, dredged out silt and fill, rebuilt the breach dam, and published an ambitious plan. Opportunities will be available for the provision of facilities for boating, picnicking, hiking, and other types of active recreation. Assuming eventual improvement in the quality of water in the Mother Brook, the report urges the construction of facilities for swimming in the pond. I did see people swimming in the old mill pond one time, but for the most part, it's become a haven for ducks, beavers, coyotes, and fishermen. It might be fun to catch some fish along the Mother Brook, but as you might guess, it's probably not a good idea to eat too many of them. After over 300 years of industrial use, the Mother Brook was intensely polluted by the mid-20th century. Over the years, everything from gasoline to PCBs to raw sewage has been leached into the stream.
In recent years, water quality on the Charles River has made a remarkable comeback, even being rated safe for swimming along much of the river. The Mother Brook has had a much slower recovery. Though the state of the brook has improved, it still has a long way to go. I volunteer as a water monitor with the Neponset River Watershed Association during the summer months. Reviewing the preliminary data from our 2017 program, the Mother Brook remains one of the most polluted tributaries of the Neponset, being unsafe for both swimming and boating, and containing unsafe levels of E. coli bacteria. Interestingly, the Mother Brook follows a pattern of contamination that is opposite that in most of the rest of the watershed. Most waterways are more polluted in wet weather, when runoff washes contaminants and sewage overflow from the surrounding area into the river. The Mother Brook, however, is considerably less contaminated when it rains, when the floodgate separating it from the Charles is open to alleviate the chance of flooding downstream on the Charles, allowing clean Charles River water to course down the Mother Brook. If you'd like to visit the Mother Brook, the easiest place to see it is at Fairview Cemetery in Hyde Park, which is also the final resting place of Dr. Rebecca Lee Crumpler, who was featured in Episode 18. However, one of the most interesting spots to visit is the floodgate itself that controls the flow of water from the Charles into the Mother Brook. To get there, get on the VFW Parkway headed south out of Boston into Dedham. Just after you cross the town line, you'll see the Dedham Mall on your left. After you pass the Uno's restaurant at 270 Providence Highway in Dedham on your left, pull into a very small parking area on the right side. A small brick shed houses the controls and motors that raise and lower the floodgate, and you'll see the water rushing over its lip into the Mother Brook. We'll post directions for a driving tour of the Mother Brook in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/059.
We'll also have links to a pamphlet about the history of the Mother Brook from 1900, and the 1827 history of Dedham, which this episode heavily features. We'll also post that 1890 bird's eye view of Hyde Park that centrally features the Mother Brook. We'll link to a few articles about the other early mill developments in Massachusetts Bay Colony, and we'll share the Bonner map that shows the location of the windmill on Copse Hill in the North End. And of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
Our last couple of episodes have really inspired feedback from you, the listener. After our last show about the 1917 Halifax explosion and the trainload of doctors and medical supplies that Boston rushed to them, Rose from the Partnership of the Historic Bostons shared a personal anecdote about the explosion. My mother-in-law was uncharacteristically late for school that day in Halifax. This was fortunate, because a beam fell across her desk and chair. Jeff Rogers was basking in the warm glow that Boston's response to this tragedy naturally inspires, and he tweeted at us to say, "This makes me proud to be a Bostonian." A listener named Portia had a darker take, comparing the quick response of one American city to a disaster in a neighboring country in 1917 to the response of the entire federal government to a disaster in an American territory in 2017. She had a dim view of our response to Hurricane Maria, saying, "In Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, it took weeks to get a U.S. Navy ship to even leave the dock on the mainland. We have sunk to new lows." Last week's show about the human computers of Harvard College Observatory also got a great response. Lindsay Smith-Zull, who curates the glass photographic plates that were the focus of the episode, wrote in to say, "Hello from the Harvard Observatory. I'm so happy to see you did an episode about the Harvard women computers." She also called us out for misidentifying some of the women in a photo we posted, provided us with some alternate photos to use instead, and offered to give us a tour of the collection. Dinah Buquin, the head librarian at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, gave us a nod, saying, "Thank you, Hub History, for featuring the work of these astronomers and our efforts to make their research more accessible." And the Smithsonian Transcription Center, which is hosting an effort to transcribe the field notes of the women who worked at the observatory, tweeted, "A great podcast to listen to while you transcribe their logbooks. Thanks for the shout-out." Finally, the Self-Rescuing Princess Society, who first clued us into the story of Wilhelmina Fleming and the Harvard computers, tweeted, "She was a pretty amazing woman, and I'm glad she's getting more attention. Adding this podcast to today's queue."
If you want to be featured in a future episode, get in touch with us. You can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, be sure to hit the subscribe link and never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It remains the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week.